This is Robert Cappuccio. Welcome to the Self-Help Antidote, a weekly dose of reason, perspective, and insight, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore authentic strategies and insights around personal transformation. Our commitment to you is to bring you some of the world's leading experts in the domains of fitness, wellness, coaching, and behavior change, separating fact from fallacy. Get ready for a powerful episode. My guest is Martin Rooney, who is the founder of Training for Warriors, an internationally recognized speaker, author, and pioneer in the strength and conditioning industry. Martin and his Training for Warriors system has been featured on ESPN, Fox Sports Net, The New York Times, Men's Health, Men's Fitness, Men's Journal, Muscle and Fitness, and countless other high-profile news outlets and publications. He's written 8 books, and we're going to talk about his newest book, High 10, on the show. Martin's been a consultant to the New York Giants, and he's also trained numerous Olympians, including 1 gold and 4 silver medalists. His Training for Warriors system has also been implemented by the Army Rangers and Army Airborne Division. And you could read the rest of his bio in the show notes because his accomplishments are a bit too extensive to cover just right here. But in this episode, what we're going to talk to you about is personal growth. How to achieve high performance in your business and life, as well as how do you discover your passion? What happens when what you're passionate about intersects with what people truly need? I mean, some of you might even be thinking, what does it mean to discover my passion anyway? Well, in this episode, we're going to share some of our perspectives on that. At times, it's going to seem like two old friends just hanging out and sharing cool ideas because in a lot of ways, that's exactly what this is. I've been friends with Martin for a long time and worked with him quite a bit in the past, back when he was with Parisi Speed School. At that point, Martin had already accomplished some pretty impressive stuff, such as training with the likes of Renzo Gracie, having been a member of the U.S. bobsled team, and training over 100 athletes that were drafted into the NFL, including setting 5 all-time records at the Combine, just to name a few. But what really impressed me about Martin was his authenticity. He was the same guy on the field, in the office, and over dinner that he was on stage. I enjoyed this conversation so much that I could have kept it going for quite a while, but we weren't exactly sure how you'd feel about a 7-hour podcast, so I trust that you'll get a ton of value out of the 1 hour and 15 minutes we spoke to each other. Martin Rooney. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, it is great to see you. I know everyone else is listening to us, but always a pleasure. And I don't know where we're going to go with this one, but I'm super excited to talk to the man, the myth, the legend, and a guy with his name that is so hard to spell, Bobby Cappuccio.
I know that name is like really weird. It's kind of like cappuccino without an N. Even saying that is weird. Like, fucking, who has like a backstory like that to their name? But yeah, you better bring it because like we got an extensive audience. We got my mom and I think 2 other people listening to this today.
Well, don't worry. I'll pull in my crew and I'll probably get 1 of my kids. Well, actually, yeah, my kids won't listen to it. But, you know, we'll probably, we might be able to get my dad. So there'll be the 5 of us.
All right. Excellent. So you just wrote another book. You are the 21st century Ken Blanchard. And your book is around teams and culture. Quite poignant at this day and age. Why? Why culture and teams out of everything you could have written about?
Well, that's an interesting question. And hey, one, to put me in the same sentence with Ken Blanchard is a biggie. And for anybody listening, if you haven't read or don't know much about him, he kind of really reinvigorated kind of what's called the business motivation genre of books. And I think they're a great teaching style. I think they're a great way to get your point across. And the point I really wanted to get across, like you mentioned, was kind of teams and culture. And man, what has happened to us the last year and a half with the pandemic, I really believe that the book and that topic is more timely than ever, where not only the companies that I've helped build, not just the teams that I was working with that continued to be successful, but also within even my family and, you know, my close relationships, I realized that where culture was the strongest, those relationships, teams, businesses really survived or even grew. But businesses that I saw that did not have a strong culture, businesses that I saw that had negative environments, those businesses aren't businesses anymore. And man, now as we come out of this, everybody's going to need this information to continue to succeed, because this isn't the last challenge we will all face. And every business is going to need a stronger culture.
So your position is that challenges that threaten the existence of your enterprise can happen, and they're going to be unpredictable, as we've seen over the past year. And what you're proposing is that culture is either the key to or the lock on your ability to survive and thrive in the face of those challenges.
Absolutely. And I'll even be strong enough to say this. We use this word a lot now, right? Like vaccine, like, have you been vaccinated? And what I would say is, using that same concept, when you have grown or designed and then built a very strong culture within your business, you are vaccinating yourself against the challenges that that business is going to face, the threats that that business will face. And a statement that I like to say that's in the new book, and the new book is called High 10, by the way, and I'll explain that today too. But when you are vaccinated, challenges are going to still happen. And when you have a strong culture, you can overcome great challenge. And we've seen that. But if you have a weak culture, you're actually going to only create more challenges for the future. So, and a great idea maybe for everybody listening, because today, hopefully we'll talk about it, because so many people, I realize that they kind of maybe understand what the word culture means, or maybe they've felt it, or they understand, oh, it has something to do with the environment, or it's, you know, the connection. But until you really understand it, man, you're probably not designing the one you want. And if you're not designing the one you want, you're leaving that up to somebody else, and really bad things can happen.
So as a baseline for the rest of the conversation, what's your personal definition of the word culture?
Wow. Well, here, well, I'm giving away a little something here, but here is the personal definition, which is really neat. Ready? Culture is the expression of your company or team or family's beliefs and values. And it's that expression, right, through their behaviors that they perform, or rituals, if you will, that happen all the time. So look at the three components. And I have a name for them in the book, so I don't want to give it away. But essentially, the three components of culture, number one is people. So you can't have a culture without people, right? Like, you got to have at least two people to have a culture between those people with the relationship. But then that culture is exhibited through their behaviors, and it represents kind of what they believe. And man, it took me a long time. You know my style, just like what I did with the book Coach to Coach. I really defined what is a coach, what is coaching, and then we built off that. And I did the same thing with culture. I said, okay, what is it? And I read everything I could get my hands on. I researched, and I really realized, wow, it comes down to three things. It's your people, and you got to have them first. If you got no people, you got no culture. Then it's the belief system, or the values, or the mission, whatever you want to call it. And then it's the regular behaviors that all your people do to carry those out. And if those are, if in alignment, if you will, then man, you're going to have a pretty strong culture, have the culture you want. But if those things are not aligned and your people are not on board and it's not connected, man, it can become a disaster really quick. And unfortunately, as we experienced, countries are like that, you know, businesses are like that, teams are like that, and it's easy to see when they get it wrong.
See, but I like what you said there about it's easy to see when they get it wrong, but what's harder is identifying why they're getting it wrong. And usually we have a story, and we have these archetypes of heroic organizations. I was working with a president of a major corporation a few years ago, and he said, okay, the conversation around Apple is banned from meetings, because everybody will always bring up Apple as a company that does things right. And what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is when an organization, it could be any organization, it could be Apple, or it could be the independent coffee shop in your local neighborhood, is creating an environment that elicits certain behaviors, high performance, but yet at the same time, high touch behaviors. It is rooted in, as well as a reflection of, what that company fundamentally believes.
Exactly. And then it's your people that, if properly selected, educated and trained, and if they do, and they are aligned with that belief system and the mission of the company, man, that's when the magic happens. So yeah, it's not about Apple. You know them all. You're going to hear about Google. You're going to hear about Amazon. You're going to hear about Apple. And I'm sure that because they're so huge, there's probably bad culture within their culture. Mm-hmm. And, but absolutely, man, how you just succinctly said it too. See, what we're doing is creating clarity around what it means. And then once you at least understand, holy cow, I have a culture within my family. I have a culture within my small business. I have a culture within my community. I have a culture within my team or my country. And then all of a sudden we can start to understand why either things are the way we want them to be or not. And then maybe start taking steps to address them. And that was the fundamental reason behind writing the book, where so many people, I think, were just paralyzed or don't either have the skills or the knowledge to be able to do. They know they have a culture they don't want, but they have no idea how to do anything about it. And I think this book, in a really interesting way, is going to have a big impact helping people do that.
You know, there's two types of people I would assume are listening to this right now. Well, it's probably more than two types of people, but
I thought there was only two people.
It doesn't really help. Yeah, there's literally two people listening to this right now. And the two types of people that are listening to this, just to stereotype further, is, yeah, I forgot the whole point I was going to make. But anyway, so person number one is going, yeah, this all sounds great. You know, culture, something we'll get to once the business grows to a certain degree. And it's kind of like, it's nice to do, but not critical to do. But the other type of person that's listening to this right now is probably like, yeah, wow, you know, I can see this. And I believe it. I feel it. I don't know exactly where to start with my people. Yeah. What would you say to that person?
Wow. Well, first thing I would say is, hey, in a couple of weeks, there's this new book called High 10. That's an easy to read fictional novel story that if you read it, you're going to get this complete roadmap. But what I would say is, if I were to probably say, hey, where do you start? And again, the story walks you through this. I would start with you. So if you are the leader of the company or leader of the team or leader of your family, and everybody in some way is, you have to first understand your values. You have to understand, hey, what is your vision? What is your mission? And does it align right now, either with the people you're around or with the business you're within? But if you are the leader of the business, man, these are all the things that you have to have in place. It's funny you said, because it is true. People will say, I'll attack this when we get a lot bigger. And see, if you don't attack it before if you even move to person number two, you're already in trouble, because that culture is going to get designed whether you like it or not. And you're going to probably end up with one you don't want. So this is this revolutionary idea that culture isn't something that happens. Culture is something that can be designed and created. And it can be realigned if it's in the wrong space, but you got to understand how to look at it. And that's what we're discussing today. And that's what got me so fired up to write this. Because when I said, hey, remember you asked me, why did I write about this? I really tried to say, well, what of all my career, what is it that I've always done well? And yes, hey, have I helped people win championships? Have I built successful businesses? Have I done a lot of things? Yes. But I started to see, man, how did I do that? Was building really cohesive and engaged cultures where people were excited to go to work and work with each other. And then I was like, wow, that's what I really did. So how do you do that? Or how did I do that? And that became the lessons behind the book. But again, where would you start? You would start with yourself, and you would start with a vision of how would you like your business to feel? How would you like everyone to experience your business? You know, this is a great one, Bobby, that I talk about in the book. Every interaction, so using that coffee company example, every interaction between staff, among staff and customers, owner and staff, is a cultural exchange. And if those exchanges don't go the right way, or they don't go the way you want them to, you're perceived as something very different than what you want to be. And, you know, right now, here would be a great example. You ready? And I'm going to throw one at you. I went to an interesting little cultural seminar the other day. And what I really loved from it was they polled the group. They said they showed a logo of McDonald's and they showed a logo of Chick-fil-A. And they said, what's the difference? Tell me what you know, they said, Chick-fil-A, tell me what you think of when you think of their culture. And they said, oh, they thought of, you know, somebody saying my pleasure. They thought of really clean places. They thought of people and customer service being very helpful. They thought being closed on Sundays and standing up for what they believed in. And then they said, great. Okay. What do you think of when you think of McDonald's? And because I don't frequent that, I didn't know, but this is what they said. They said, expect your order to be wrong. Expect bad service. Expect it to be dirty. And it was just all this negativity. And it's funny because when I was a kid and I did go to McDonald's, there was a very different culture that I remember that people, you know, understood McDonald's as. But it goes back to these little exchanges over time will tell everybody else what you're about. So some big stuff there. I know your brain's probably spinning. Hit me with something.
My brain's exploding right now because there's so much to unpack there. And there's so much that deeply resonates with me. There's two things that's popping into my mind right now. And lately I'm being so redundant, not like I was ever not redundant in the past, but it's gotten worse because things are coming up that are critical themes. And one thing that's coming up is Peter Drucker. I was talking about Drucker like a couple of days ago where he was saying that the purpose of a business, and what's amazing is we've gotten to a point in society where you run into a lot of people that contest this and they disagree. And he said, the purpose of a business is to create and keep a customer. And don't even talk about the money conversation or even worse, the altruism or a company's responsibility to contribute to the communities that they're in. Because if you're not creating and keeping a customer, you don't have the resources, nor the platform, nor the demonstrated sincerity of what you stand for to do any of that. So, but then the conversation went deeper because most executives around the world that Drucker spoke to, they would kind of concede to that. Yeah, we're creating and keeping customers. That's how every business succeeds. That's how every business barely survives. Without that, you're not even going to be in existence to worry about it. But where things got contentious is he would say, who's your most important customer? And that's where the bullshit brigade was marching full speed ahead. And they were talking about, well, the next customer, the one that's in front of you. He's like, no, that's erroneous. Your most important customer is your employees, because that is the channel through which your client, your member, your customer experiences everything that you offer. And if it's not your employees and your experiences are broken, your organization's broken. You're not going to create and keep customers because you're not touching them at a visceral level. If you're not touching them at a visceral level, your whole relationship is transactional, but it's not transformational. Now, fast forward to the year 2000. This is where else my brain went. Pine and Gilmore wrote, you know, you read a lot of books. I think me and you have talked about this extensively. The books you read before have shaped the way your mind is framed to determine what you're going to get out of the books you're currently reading and will. But every so often you come across a book where you're like, that made a difference. That completely shifted my perspective, or that set me on a micro mission. And Pine and Gilmore's The Experience Economy back in the year 2000 was one of those for me, because they said that, you know, work is theater and every business is a stage. And I think what they were saying is what a Fortune 500 company has in common with a four-person personal training studio or a team or the guy that has that coffee shop on the corner is it's about soul. It's got to mean something. Yes, your coffee's got to be good, but that's table stakes. You know, if you have shit coffee, you're going to lose customers. What is the soul? What do you stand for? What are the feelings that's evoked? And they said that experiences are as distinct from services as services are from goods. And how they delineated that was by saying that services are merely intangible. You're buying something that's nothing more than a promise because it doesn't exist at the time of purchase. So it has to be delivered. Where experiences are staged and they're memorable. And if it's not memorable in a provocative, compelling way, it doesn't build that cohesion. It doesn't build that relationship.
Yeah. Well, right there, and everybody that's probably listening's mind is blown if you understand where we're at. And that's why I always love talking to Bobby, because he's not only one of the most well-read guys I know, but also the way he can get the points across. And to do a little more translating, so Drucker, remember, is his most famous line is culture eats strategy for breakfast. So that is, I mean, so just, you know, going back on, you know, as soon as you said brought Drucker up, that, so any, if anybody's ever heard that, that's Peter Drucker, the management guru, if you will, who coined that. But the things that you had said that I thought was very interesting is you talked about the soul and you talked about the experience. And guys, whether you want to say that is culture or it's definitely a reflection of culture, that would be about as closely as you could define it, or at least what I try to define in my new book. And again, you described it as who is the most important people for that? It's your people. So every time I kept saying people, I meant your staff, or I meant the people that work for you, not the customers first. And what I loved, going all the way back to what you said originally, is I meet so many people today that want to start a business and they have no idea what they want their culture to be, but they've already figured out what their charity will be. And they've created this story that'll hopefully get somebody engaged and how much they'll give away of the profit to some organization. And it's just, man, they're skipping so far forward that you've really missed what you're completely about. And like you said, if you don't get the culture right and create an incredible experience, you're never going to get to utilize all those other things anyway. So those are add-ons after you've built something great. You know, like Starbucks, for example, they created a culture. They created this coffee house feel that didn't exist. It's not even about the coffee anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was about this experience and the culture that people wanted to be part of. And then you worry about all the other stuff. No one cared in the beginning what the altruism was behind Starbucks. Hey, they get to talk about it now, but it was first that experience, first that culture. And it started with the leaders and the people that worked there, which they were big on. You know, that was the first time I'd ever heard the word barista, where now I'll tell you what, when I experience them now, they're slipping a little bit too. And maybe they've forgotten a little bit about that, you know?
Well, I think what they contributed to society that, you know, it's been such a part of our culture, we forgot about it. Yeah. They implemented third space, where it was the place to be between home and the office, between home and the studio, between home and wherever. And it created a platform where a lot of these independent coffee shops that, you know, God, if I find an independent coffee shop that does things well, I mean, we have one in University Heights here. I live in San Diego now. They're amazing. And I go there all the time with my wife. But it was that third space that created that model where it's like before that, you wouldn't just hang out and work or pull up your laptop or have conversations in a coffee shop the way you would when that's so embedded in our culture, we don't even recognize it anymore. It's just the way things are.
Yeah, it's a connection, right? And I say that a lot too, that, hey, you'll love this one. You ready? Are you ready? Because this is another line from the book and I'm giving some of these away.
Hold on. Let me put my feet flat on the floor.
Yeah, before you know, so I can see your vertical jump. But what I say, and you're going to appreciate this, is I say, trying to make it as simple, right? What you just said, all these things. Now I'm going to bring it down to four words. Ready? No contact, no culture. So not only do you need people, but then you need connections, communication, contacts between those people. And whether it's a physical contact, whether it's talking across a table, that's where the experience is delivered. That's how things are transferred. And that's how a culture is built. And it took me the pandemic to realize that. So what happened in, say, Training for Warriors and our fitness businesses, man, it started to remove our contact points. You couldn't go to the gym and people weren't used to working out on Zoom. So all of a sudden, If you had no contact points, you no longer have a culture. And if you have no culture, you have no business because the people are going to stop paying. So I had to continue to figure out contact points that we could create around the requirements of not being face-to-face or skin-to-skin. And I really believe that's how my organization survived because we understood that with no contact, there is no culture. And those contacts, those micro contacts are cultural exchanges. And you as the leader of your company, if you have not designed how those should happen, just like Chick-fil-A has created that the exchange is my pleasure. You don't say my pleasure, you don't work at Chick-fil-A. So they've created that little micro exchange, which leads to their macro culture. And this is all the stuff that within this story that I've written, when you read it, you're going to understand, you're going to be able to really look at with a microscope of your own business, but then you're going to be able to create these to make sure you not only have the culture you want, but you can actually fix the problems if you have right now the culture you don't want.
You know, when I'm listening to you say all that, no contact, no culture, you can even flip that, no culture, no contact, yep. Not in a meaningful way anyway, because yep. People are drowning in a sea of sameness. We have more choices and more outlets and more mediums of communication competing for our mind share than we ever dreamed we would have just 5 years ago. And if your culture doesn't resonate on a value-driven level, because I think values are what directs people's behaviors. It's what causes them to resonate and do things that they'll justify doing anything to uphold a value. I mean, the things that when we look at people go, well, you need discipline and you need more grit. Maybe what people are saying, not by their behaviors of commission, but omission, is I cannot seem to find a link between what I say I want to do and what I deeply value. And therefore, the motivation's not there because the relevance is not there. And this came up in a conversation a few days ago. Godin's book, Tribes, We Need You to Lead. I remember one of the most brilliant things he said in that book, in a book filled with brilliant comments, was the power of a tribe, and you could say culture, is not who belongs to it, but who doesn't. You're never going to attract everybody. I mean, what's the best thing that ever happened to Harley Davidson? And I know people are tempted to say men in beards wearing leather, but nope, it's actually Ducati. It's actually Suzuki, you know, it's actually Kawasaki. It's actually all of these other bikes that are very well designed and they have their market, yeah. But they're not the same person that would ride a Harley.
Well, and it defines, it helps. You ready for this? What also happens, then it helps Harley actually define who they are.
Yes.
Without even having to do it themselves. They say, this is us, right? And here's something it's interesting because you said it. It's almost as if you've read the book already. I think you're going to be disappointed because you're going to be like, yep, I already read this without even reading.
Damn it, Martin.
But what is right in the inside flap is it says in today's war for attention, like that's what we have right now, which you essentially said, we're in a war. If you're in a business, you are in a war for someone's attention. And it's not just that culture needs to exist, but I'll be bold enough to say that culture is your competitive advantage for the future. So if you don't have something that either stands out or resonates with a specific group, again, like you said, you're dead meat because you can't compete with all the other things that exist. And it's so funny because we've already deep dove so deep that I think people have probably never thought about either the word culture or the concept of culture like we've already described it. But man, once you really go down there, you realize, holy cow, it's like walking into a room in your house that you've never been in before and you need to fix it up really quick because it's not right. And I'm hoping again that this book starts that conversation for people but makes it easy again to understand. It's not a textbook. Because those are hard. I get it. Like a lot of people don't read like us and a lot of people maybe don't have the time or don't want to invest the time in it either. So the magic was also being able to make it easy to understand, put it into a story that'll engage them along the way. But just like how you described Tribes, which was a big book for me a long time ago, these are all books that you're never the same after you've read them. And that's what I'm hoping that happens with High 10.
You know, sometimes people read books like this and they get inspired. Other times they get nervous. Have you ever gotten somebody say, but Martin, I don't really know what I believe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, but see, and that's not a negative. That's a positive, because now they're asking the question. Now, the only thing is, the only person that can come up with that answer is them. But what it requires is, just like, you know, Bobby, you and I have known each other a long time. And hey, we have performed. It's almost, it's this rite of passage if you want to be a great leader. And that is, you've got to deep dive into yourself and you've got to find out. You have to discover what you believe. And there are many books that it'll lead you on the path to help you do that. And whether it's figuring out your moral compass, whether it's figuring out your purpose or your mission, these are things that, it's not something you do in 5 minutes. It's not something you do in a week either. But when you start to see a spark of it, or you get your idea around it, only then will you be able to lead. Because if you have no idea what you want and where you're going, you're never going to help somebody else do it. And I definitely believe that probably the greatest leaders of culture, they are crystal clear and have great clarity about what they want, where they're going, and what they want their business to look like.
One of my favorite CEOs that I've ever worked closely with introduced me to a term that I use constantly now. It's become part of my language. It's called originating intention. And he defined it as something that is so sacred to you, because you might not be clear on what you believe, but those beliefs are there. Like, what is it in your life? What's the experience? Who are the people, the environment, the principles that you feel so strongly about that you want it for everyone? And here's the key: without condition. It's not like, yeah, I want it for you. Well, if you go out and earn it, you just freely, with reckless abandon, want it for yourself and you want it for others. And it's like, when you get into that zone, you can't stop thinking about it. You can't stop talking about it. Even if that conversation is not outward, it's somewhere in the back of your head. It's inward. And I think that concept of originating intention is quite directive, as it is a mechanism for clarity. Because some people would say that you're either your shadow, the person that emerges when you feel insufficient, or when you feel threatened, or when there's ambivalence, there's conflict, or your originating intention. And if you examine yourself and how you determine your shadow is how it was taught to me. What do you say to yourself when someone is about to fail you? And not fail you because they just don't have the capacity. It's an intentional betrayal. There's something that you say to yourself when you're in those situations, and that's your shadow self. But when you feel open and you feel safe and you feel inspired, you feel energized, there's something that you are for people, and there's something that people become for you. And that's the originating intention. And there's a belief there, because there's a value there, and there's a belief about how that value is upheld when it's expressed in the world.
Well, and I agree 100%. And again, everybody listening, I get it. This stuff is very deep. We have spent a lot of time on this. This is not something, again, this isn't a weekend course. And hey, on Sunday, I'm gonna know who I am, my shadow self, my deepest wants, and my entire culture will be defined, and I'll start it up on Monday. And it's a process too. But here's one, Bobby, you might like, because as you were saying that, some things popped out to me. And how I like to describe it sometimes is, it would also be, I usually start with passion. So I'll ask people, what is it you're passionate about? What is it that you find yourself doing that you can't not be doing? What is it that, even if you didn't get paid for it, what would it be, something that you would still want to spend a lot of your time on? Now, right there, say you've got passion. Then, hey, what is something, can you find an intersection, right? Can you find an intersection with that, with something that either a person, people, a group, or the world needs? And here's something that I heard recently, and you'll really love this. It's so that passion, right? And the authentic self, like you were just talking about, I call that like a deep want. There's some kind of deep want in there that is something, if you uncover it, you'll know where it is. See, my deep want is to make a world of better coaches. My deep want now is to help people understand the concept of culture to fix businesses and countries, maybe globally. But also, I know it's important because there's a deep need, right? Like, so the world really needs it too. And man, when you find that intersection between that, that's where you find boundless energy. That's where there's just this reservoir of energy that will allow you to do the work you never thought was possible, but you got to do the first work to tap into it. And that's understanding who you are, what you want, and why you're doing it. And I'll be honest, most people, Bobby, cannot answer that. If you walked up to somebody on the street and you said, hey, tell me your deepest want or your passion and your purpose and how that integrates into what the world really needs and how you're going to spend your time on that, man, people have spent more time thinking about what show they're going to watch on Netflix tonight than they have about really planning out the rest of their lives. And man, it's unfortunate, but for anybody listening, you got to do the work at like anything else. Oh, here's a new Rooneyism. Are you ready, Bobby?
I'm ready.
Work comes before the word worth in the dictionary, but it also comes before the same way in life, you know, in the game of life. So you got to do the work first. You won't get all the stuff after if you don't do the work. And hey, most people aren't prepared to do the work. So if you do it, man, you're going to have a business or a family or a culture that you can't imagine.
See, I don't know if a lot of people aren't prepared to do the work. I think it goes back to what you were saying a few minutes earlier, where they don't absolutely know.
Yeah.
There is this uncertainty. And I love how you put it. What can you not live without? Like, it's not, what is it that you want to do? What can you not do?
Yeah, what can you not
and still remain sane? Like, what is it that calls to you? And it's kind of like Bukowski's essay on writing, where his advice is don't do it. And it goes through all these outcomes. If you want money, if you want fame, if you want women, don't do it. What he basically comes to is the only time you should ever be a writer is if you can be nothing else. Like it will not leave you alone. It will torment you until you surrender to it. And that's beautiful. And passion, you know, a lot of people think it's like, what am I so excited about? The root of passion doesn't come from excitement. It comes from suffering. What would you suffer for? Viktor Frankl, who I know you've read Man's Search for Meaning, where he defines despair as suffering in the absence of meaning. Well, then what is suffering in the presence of meaning? I think that's passion. Yeah. And when you find that, I think people are not only willing to do the work, I think that they can't help it, because that investment in work becomes the most fulfilling use of your time, or one of, if it's rooted in values. I think when people are constantly struggling to get themselves to do the work and they're watching Netflix, that's not laziness, that's distraction right there. Unless there's something really good on Netflix, and then, well, that's a reasonable viewing choice. But
well, I think we're, and what are we doing? What is this podcast today? Hey, we're trying to create clarity for you, the listener, right? Like, we're trying to create clarity of, hey, what is the concept of culture? And then, wow, as we dig deeper, well, to have culture, you've got to be a leader. Well, hey, to be a leader, you've got to understand your values. To understand your values, you've got to understand your passions. And you see how each one of these layers of the onion that we unwrap, each one of them involves work. But what we're trying to convince you, the listener, is the work is worth it. And there's nothing more famous of stories of people who have toiled. Just like you said with Bukowski's writing. And it's funny because I've just read a handful of other writers that almost all said the same thing. To consider yourself a real writer, and I wrote about this recently because I had had an identity crisis for a long time. When people would ask me what I did, I never mentioned that I wrote. I never mentioned I had written 12 books. I didn't ever introduce myself as an author. When I would land in another country on the immigration documents, I never penned the word author, writer, scribe. And it was because I didn't identify with what I was really passionate about. But now when I see, how do I get my points across? What do I really enjoy? How do I really love playing with words and watching something come together. And I'll tell you what, writing this last book, after hearing your definition, Bobby, I would definitely call it a passion, because I suffered. There was no doubt there was despair during the entire process, but it's because it had meaning and I knew what I was doing. Every day I got up and did it again, no matter what.
But you can't create anything without suffering.
Yeah.
Because in the beginning, your brain doesn't even have the focused attention to induce the mental state to allow information, that point where you're writing and information is not coming from you, it's flowing through you. You know, you need to elevate your stress hormones just a little bit to get your brain into that state in the first place. My wife, she's a filmmaker. And you know, when she's writing a script, she has her 7-minute rule. And that 7-minute rule is, it's the hardest when you're sitting down and you're staring at that cursor and you don't know what the next thoughts in your head are going to be. And she just writes for 7 minutes. I remember her yelling at me, like, sit down and do this. I was like, yeah, but like, what do I do? She's like, just keep moving your fingers on that keyboard and do not stop for 7 minutes for any reason, not even for a pause. I was like, but what if I'm a fucking idiot and I can't think of anything? Well, write that down. That's a perfect thing to write down. Don't even worry about spelling. She said, you do that for 7 minutes. You don't have to worry about what you're going to write. It'll be revealed to you. God, and wow, does that work?
Well, she might appreciate this. I remember hearing about an app a friend told me about, because, hey, writer's block. I don't know if I've ever experienced writer's block, but I have experienced maybe starter's block. And what do I mean by that? That I would always keep procrastinating, right? I would storyboard or I would take notes and create this concept, but I was never sitting down to just get going. And I remember with both Coach to Coach and High 10, as soon as I really got started, and then I just, even just that first sentence or just getting something down, it all just started to flow. And I've definitely experienced that. And I know you probably have too. It's one of the biggest things I miss about presenting and speaking, is that sometimes my greatest ideas would come to me like almost like an antenna when I'm just up there on stage and just something would come to me. And I would say, somebody write that down, because I'm not going to remember what I just said. And that is the magic. But this app I was going to tell you about, is I met this writer, and I don't even know what it's called, but maybe she can find out. It was an app, and you start writing, right? But if you stop, the text starts to disappear. And if you stop long enough, it's gone. So you just have to keep writing or it's going to be gone. And then once you've written for either that time frame or whatever else, it gives you that document. So it's almost another.
I would crack under pressure. That's too much pressure for me. I would freak out and smash my computer.
You throw your computer against a wall, and or you write your greatest thing ever and then it disappears. But but using that same concept, that what are we saying there? Hey, just get going and the magic will come. But if you're always just waiting around to get started, nothing happens. And yeah, maybe that's it too. So if it's about discovering your passion, about understanding your business, your culture, about your relationships with your family, whatever it is, hey, just get going and the stuff will come to you. But man, the magic will never happen if you don't do anything about it.
I think that's also where craft comes in as well, where it is the structured repetition that refines a skill to where it seems like creation on demand. So when you get up, I mean, it feels like it's coming through you in front of an audience, but it's not really. Like, what's coming through you in front of the audience is the hundreds of times that you've been presenting in front of an audience, and the hundreds of times, because I know you do this, where you're presenting, but there is no audience and your family is like, oh, he's gone fucking nuts again. He's just talking to a wall. And you actually are talking to a wall because you're going through that mental rehearsal, because you just read your like 600th book. and something grabbed your attention and you got up and presented it. So you're going through the formulation and refinement of craft so often to where even if you step on stage and you're not particularly feeling very well, how many times have, you know, we had too little sleep and too many miles, and then you get on stage and you're like running a fever, but you're able to pull it out once you get in that zone because of craft. And it's that refinement of craft is critical.
Well, and that what you were hitting right there, what was exploding in my head was it's that famous, I believe it's attributed to Michelangelo, where it always says, you know, somebody had appreciated his work and he said, man, if you knew how long and how hard I've worked to be able to do that, you wouldn't think it's so great at all. You know, and I think what he's saying is, yeah, it's just that lifetime of work to create craft that someone else appreciates as something amazing, but it's not that amazing at all. And again, that's a culture, that's a business. It's all of those things. And I think that's a breakthrough too, is how am I able to do what I do with teams? You know, this past year, I was again a high school coach and we had all these records again. And there's just this culture that we've instilled where the kids have so much fun and they all want to come back, which I think is a big indicator of your culture too, if they all commit to come back the next year. And that only happened because of the 20 years before that of learning how to do it. And it might look so hard to somebody else, but yeah, for somebody that's done it so long, because they have that, you know, they're a craftsman, it looks kind of easy.
Okay. You just said craftsman. My concern when it comes to a lot of work, because I develop coaching teams, I have around the world, it's the pursuit of abbreviation and automation. Now, I think everything that is scalable should be scaled, but nothing more. Where there is a time and a commitment to mastery. And mastery has to be part of that culture because mastery energizes. When you've got the right people on the right team and the right culture resonating with the core values, that craft, that suffering, that work, that time you put in is intensely rewarding, not only in the outcome, but it's invigorating the process. The payoff is in the process. When you talk about culture, Drucker's quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast. I absolutely love that perspective from Drucker. And that was something that CEO I was talking about earlier, he believed in deeply. Where this really comes to fruition, maybe it's a bad example, who knows, maybe it's a good one, but you're gonna give it anyway, so let's see. I remember I was the head of fitness training and development for a major health club chain. And this is back when I was with NASM. So I went in and took that role as a consultant. And there was a disagreement about developing presenters. And you can't scale it. We didn't have the technology where you can present from an app, but they wanted it duplicatable. So it was like, okay, you get your whole deck, all your PowerPoint presentations, and you have a word for word script. And what they wanted was you would memorize the script. So the notes in the PowerPoint would be so explicit and so detailed. And they wanted you to basically hand it off to an instructor and get in front of the room and just say what you're going to say. There's so many problems with that. One, God, that's going to be a really shit presentation. I mean, send them a book, because why would you want people to suffer through that? Two, you're training people to be completely disconnected and not present and not able to listen and respond to the energetic shifts in the room that tell you where people are. That's not inviting. And what happens when you're not developing craft and something goes wrong? And all this person knows how to do, and they're like, well, what you're talking about, it takes too much time and resources and energy. This is like many, many years ago. And one day, one of these people that was such a proponent of the scripted teaching methodology, they showed up and the projector didn't work. So they couldn't project the slides on the screen. And the PowerPoint slides, the notes, didn't show up. So the two worst things that can happen. And now you have people that all they know how to do is recite from a script. But there's not the craft where you know your shit cold and you have these mental models to where even if information's missing, you can pull from it, or you know the objectives or where you want to take those students and what's most important to convey, that's not catastrophic at all. Sometimes that's an opportunity, but now you're completely handicapped. So it's like craft is one of those things where it's kind of like getting a jet plane off the runway. You got to hold that throttle down, full throttle. But once you get up in the air, you can let go of that because you have the air currents to carry you. So it actually saves energy. It saves time. It allows you to be more flexible and nimble. Anyway, probably just going off on one there.
No, but especially being a presenter. So, you know, if I were to this, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be Bobby's translator right now. So, hey, being a presenter is not so scalable. Everybody brings their unique stuff to the game. And it sometimes takes a lifetime of mastery to really be appreciated as a master. But that work is worth it, because if you've got enough of those people within your own business, holy cow, some real magic is going to happen versus a bunch of soldiers that don't believe in your business, what you do, and don't really understand it in the first place or themselves. And, you know, and it sounds like that's exactly what happened to you, where on paper, that makes great sense. Like, hey, let's have everybody present this. They just never really thought about that everybody's going to go and present it lousy, and then it can actually kill your business. Because again, that's another cultural exchange. And now everybody will say, this organization is dry and it doesn't work.
You know, information is so overrated. I mean, we're living in an age where we have more information than we do application. I think the economist Neil Postman called that a technopoly. What's critical is that you not only connect the right information to the right people for the most relevant circumstances, but somehow galvanize and compel people to act upon it. And you know, there's no original thoughts out there. And it goes back to soul in my mind, where what makes information come alive or become completely monotonous and redundant is the delivery. And it's like when you work that craft and you're not thinking so much about the words you say because you've gone through so much repetition, it's like it just comes out of you. What's left there is you. Is that authenticity. It is delivering it from a place of personal meaning, personal passion, where you can have a human to human experience, where you can present and listen to a room simultaneously and be completely present to what's occurring and what shifts are happening. It comes down to that soul. It is communicating with a soul.
Well, and again, and what are we talking about there? If you thought about that across an entire organization, again, that soul is a very close definition to your culture, right? Like, because it is hard. It's hard to say, hey, what is culture? I tried to give a definition today, but man, maybe if you brought it down to one word, it would be like, yeah, the soul or the life force. That might be a word, like the life force of your organization that you can't see. And here's a great example, an analogy. You know me, I work with a lot of different equipment companies within the fitness industry. And it's interesting because just like you said, information is not really an advantage anymore. Well, now imagine you've got, you know, just like we talked about coffee today. Now imagine you make racks, right? Like you make racks, which essentially what's a rack for? A rack is to kind of hold plates and maybe hold your bar while you're squatting or benching in it. That's about it. Maybe you'll do some chin-ups off it if you want to, you know, scale it like Mount Everest and hang from the top and hopefully not hurt yourself. So really, here's this piece of equipment. It's made of the same steel. Maybe they look slightly different, but not much because it does a certain thing. But I've noticed the most successful companies, and in particular, I've recently worked with a few, and it's like they built an entire feeling and energy and culture around, but in a weird way, around the rack. And now all of a sudden you got all these people that are just like diehards for this rack versus another rack. And that business is doing incredible. And then other businesses are going out of business. And what I'm getting at, or what you were saying today, guys, it's a rack. Like it's a steel inanimate rack. And even that, you can create an entire culture around it that now could become $100 million business for you, and another business that does the same stuff, buys it from the same suppliers, and they go out of business because they can't make any money. And that, again, is this revealer of culture and your people and what they believe and how they're bought in and the stories you tell. And that's what I'm so excited about, because the last few years, it's just where I've spent all my time. And yeah, we get this clarity of, it's not about the coffee, right? Like, it's about all the, like you said today, you said, man, it's a place to go. It's your third spot. You go there and do work. You go and have a conversation. You didn't say I go there because the coffee's great.
It's part of your identity. Yeah. I'm a Starbucks type of person. Yeah, I'm studious.
I'm an artist.
Yeah. Exactly. And when you talk about the rack, I think way back to like when Roy Simonson created Free Motion, it was a philosophy.
Yeah.
That was a culture where we stand for the same things. And it's like, it wasn't equipment that I would use. It's something like, you can be a part of this movement.
Yeah.
So there's this incredible identification with a large number of fitness professionals in the industry back then.
Well, and you remember, I mean, we were all involved with them, and mm-hmm. remember we'd go to those Ursa shows, and it was, yeah, you know, it was so exciting. But do you see how we didn't even understand it then, but they were smart enough to get you to see that you were buying in. If somebody became part of it or used that equipment, you were, like two words. You said part of a movement and then maybe becoming part of something bigger. And that is this necessary need we have as human beings. We want to be part of something. We want to affiliate with something mm-hmm. else. And hey, I know with my Training for Warriors organization, I know who we're for, I know who we're not for, and I know people love it. Like, look, like, yeah, we do push-ups, we lift weights, we move around. It's not about that. Just like the rack, what we're about, it's a culture that you become part of. Again, a tribe, if you will. And these are all the things, again, that, hey, for anybody listening, this happens in your home, this happens in your business, in your community, and it's something that you can help design once you really understand it. And I don't think a lot of people are having conversations like this, like we're talking about right now. And that's what's invigorating about it too.
Well, you can kind of say that all things being equal, you become more infectious, more influential when you decide with conviction what it is you believe and how those values express those beliefs in the world. And the expression of your values, Martin Seligman, where he talks about the values and action perspective, I love that, is when you're acting on your values and expressing that in the world, they're expressed as signature strengths. And when you have that belief, values, and expression of signature strengths, you become quite attractive, not to everybody, but to the right people. It's that resonance.
Yeah, well, and here's one. And every time you say something, it's like, it hits me with an idea. You'll love this one. I say this a lot with our organization because we have our core values. And I'm going to give you an interesting question in a second. So remind me, I want to ask a question, see what you think. Because there was one thing that was very challenging for me about the book when it comes to values. But how I understand values, you ready for this? So for instance, you might say, hey, what are your values? And somebody might say courage. Somebody might say, ambition, you know, something, but
you're like mind reading right now. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, get ready. So how I understand them is your values aren't just nouns. They're also verbs. And it's a great way to understand them. So, hey, whatever it is that you, this thing, this noun you say you stand for, well then, hey, it's also got for it to be real, you've got to make it a verb and really take action, which shows you are following those values. And that's what that's how I understand a value is that it should direct your every action. And if you're very clear on what those are, then you know what you will do and what you won't do. Right. And that's how values work.
Oh yeah. If you look back at things that you have made excuses to do that other people would probably make excuses to avoid, that's indicative of a value right there.
Value system.
The problem with values is we get them confused. Most people confuse values with social contracts. Like, what do you value? Well, I value honesty. As opposed to what? Like, what were the other options you were considering? Or I value my family. I'm not saying your family isn't important to you, but especially when you ask this question, how long have you known? How long before you had your first kid did you know you wanted a family? A lot of times people, they didn't know. Yeah. They didn't plan for it, but other times, like, oh, but for a long time, you know, I always knew. Well, what did you imagine you would be doing, like, in that family environment with those kids? What does that give you? Like, think back to your most sacred family memory. What was it about that? Those are values. Yeah. So maybe it was love. Maybe it's safety. Like a really good friend of mine, good example, he values exploration and adventure. And he's got three boys. And when he teaches them something for the first time and they go out and do something and they've got this wide-eyed wonder and then they screw it all up and they laugh about it and they learn from that and try to get, for him, that is nirvana. Yeah. So his family become, as all of our families become, an environment that cultivates our values where we can live out those values.
I love it. And it's funny, you're getting me almost to the question I had. And one of the battles, right? Like, one of the things that I saw that was the biggest obstacles, not only creating values, for myself and then for, say, the companies that I've worked with, because we've gone through those procedures. And I think you've been part of some of those with us too, is that I really believe one of the biggest disconnects is, for instance, imagine you and I are running a company and then we write down 5 core values and now we write them down on the walls and, well, Bobby and I like them. So now everybody else, this is how you're going to live and this is how you're going to operate. And here's a bold statement that I say in the book, and you're going to like this. I'll say, you're going to have a hard time, you know, internally accepting certain values when they've been externally given. Does that make sense? So I don't believe you can ram values down somebody's throat. And yet I think that's this disconnect where people misunderstand values, that they'll say, oh, look, Google's, these are their values on the wall. I saw it on the internet. So we're going to make those our values too. They're really cool. I like those. Let's stand for them. And they decided that in a minute. Where I will say this, and it's pretty interesting. Training for warriors, we have some core values. All our people know them. Not only do they live them, they tattoo them on themselves. But the unique thing about it was that we all built it together. They're international. Mm-hmm. We built them as groups over time. It took a decade to put them together, you know, and it was all organic. It was something that would happen. And this would be this either theme or idea that we would play with for a year. And then it was almost all accepted it together. Versus most of the time, it's some executives in a room with a consultant. And in 3 days, they leave 3 days later and they've got 5 words that no one really cares about and probably couldn't tell you what they are anyway.
Yeah.
And
if you want to scare the shit out of a group of middle-aged people in an executive suite, tell them that the CEO is going on a retreat that weekend. Scariest fucking thing they've ever heard. Like when that CEO gets back, shit's going to get laminated.
We're laminating. Everybody's got new values, but you know, and you got to memorize this new acronym, but here's the interesting part. Where I had a challenge in my book was values are though very important and such a central piece to culture. I had to, within the story, have some developed so people could see how they work. And that is something that I'll say though, that I wish, you know, I would have had to have written a 1,000-page book to develop it over a 10-year span and deliver them versus just delivering them. But what I'm getting at is that I think one of the fundamental flaws in the whole idea is usually a company exists, say for like Starbucks. Imagine using them as the example again. Let's say Starbucks started with a few people, then it got bigger, then it explodes. Now we got 1,000 units, and then we make up our core values and now post them on the wall. I believe it's too late at that point. We got all these people that they never knew what they were in the first place. Those cultures are already developed. So I am, I guess, saying, and I'm having a breakthrough here, man. That's why, again, it starts with person number one, that you got to know a lot of this stuff before it gets rolling. Because if the ball really gets rolling and gets too far away from you, you're never going to be able to ram these new values down 100 or 1,000 people's throats that they won't accept them.
See, I'm not even thinking about companies. I'm thinking on a personal level. I believe, and I don't know if this is true, but I believe it, that when we get stuck, we say we want one thing, but we do another thing. Or when we lose this enduring battle, we wage with ourselves. It's a battle of fatigue, ultimately. It's because we're living out a script that was not written by us. Somebody else has written a narrative based on their values and expectations and handed them to us, and we accepted it, and we subjugate our true values for the values we think we should have. And that's when the lack of discipline comes up. That's where the laziness comes up. That's where a lot of inconsistency comes up. I don't know if it's true, but I strongly believe it.
I'm right with you. Here's what I would always say. Kindergarten, along with maybe some ABCs, we should be asking kids, what do they stand for? What do they think about with themselves? Who are they? Right? Yeah. And like you said, instead, there's a narrative. Like you said, it's like, hey, you should value honesty, and which I believe everybody should. But what I'm getting at is, it's almost like, yeah, we've got these morals or values hammered into us, but then we never really accept our own truth. And like you said, what's funny? It's coming full circle. When you see greatness in someone else or a true master, you're viewing that authentic person because they've somehow broken all the way through to now have spent so much time on their own personal mission and around their values that we're magnetized to it like a moth to the flame, because it's so rare that you see anybody do it. But really what it was,
I think brilliant.
Yeah. They just broke through exactly what you were talking about. They didn't fight the battle long enough of, oh my gosh, everybody in the world's telling me to do this, but instead I want to do this. Here would be a great personal story, Bobby. And it's so funny. Everybody told me I should be a therapist, a physical therapist. Everybody's like, you should be a physical therapist. That's a good job. It's really up and coming. That's going to be this great thing. I spent 7.5 years of undergraduate and then graduate school, become a therapist. And I get out and realize this isn't what I want to do. And the horror of the story, or the tragedy of the story, is then for the next 3.5 years, I continued to do every day what I didn't want to do until I had a knot in my gut, my stomach is hurting, I feel so unhealthy. And then when I started telling people it's not what I want to do, everybody said, are you out of your mind? You got to do this. This is a good job. This is what you're supposed to do. This is this cool thing. And it's almost like, yeah, you never want to use the word brainwashed or something else, but we're programmed into how things should be for us. But nobody ever asked me what I wanted to do. Nobody really ever said, hey, what do you really want? And until I said, you know what? I want to be around fitness. I want to be around sport. That's what I really love. And I'll tell you what, the hardest thing in the world was to leave therapy because everybody said I was out of my mind. But the greatest thing that I ever did, and I would never be talking to you now if I didn't, was leave to pursue what I was truly passionate about. And that was over 20 years ago. And now, since, every day I read the books I wanted to read. I made the mistakes I had to make to gain the mastery that I've tried to achieve. And that has made it where the businesses have come from, the speaking engagements, the books. And it never would have happened if I never would have gone through that process of breaking away what everybody thought I should do, and then digging into who I was and what I really wanted. So
I think when you encounter those people, and we all do, they tell you like when you should be married, that you definitely have to have kids by when you need the kids, what type of house to live in and where, and what occupation. And they seem animate. And you're tempted to, why are you so invested in this?
Yeah.
Like, seriously, like what I do is not going to affect your life, but I think it does, because I don't think they're invested in what you should do. They're probably not sure about what they should do for a lot of the reasons we talked about. And if they're following rules that they did not have a hand in crafting themselves, and you're not following those same rules, it makes them terrified.
Yeah, it hurts them. Yeah.
What if the rules are wrong?
And that's culture. Think about it though. What all those things you just said, that's part of our culture, right? So United States, hey, you you should probably be married by 30. And hey, when I was younger, it was even earlier, right? Like, and when it was our parents, it was, let's say it was 20, you know, 20, 21, then maybe it moved to 25, 30. Now maybe 35 is more acceptable, but still people would be like, hey, you should be married. You should have kids. You should have this job. And hey, the world is always evolving, but do you see the power of how the culture that's hammered into people, how strongly people will follow that, right? Like, and, you know, so it is kind of interesting though. What I was just thinking is I've heard before that, hey, when so many people haven't reached their dreams, they kind of try to stop you from reaching yours. It's almost the same thing that you said right there. It was like, well, wait a minute. I followed all these rules, so you better do it too. Cause I wasn't happy about it, but I got to make sure everybody else is unhappy too.
Yeah. Or it's like, are these the right rules for me? And if there's somebody else who's defecting, they've left the tribe. It's like, what does that mean for me?
Yeah.
Because if I don't base my certainty on my own internal values and compass, I base my certainty to a degree on concession. And when that concession diminishes, so does my level of assurance. And that can be a terrifying position to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that, hey, I guess, what are we saying too? And just riffing on it is, hey, there's culture, right? And there are these underlying currents that everyone is expected to follow. And hey, we have those, right? So, hey, you shouldn't steal, you know, we got our laws and I think we should abide by them. But then there are these ideas, like you said, like, hey, well, you should just have a secure job, or hey, you should just be happy with what you get. But there are these mavericks, right? And maybe you call them cultural mavericks, like, and whether you want to say the Elon Musks or the Bezoses, all these people that we deify, but what were they? They were mavericks that did things a different way or looked at things in a different way than what everybody else would think how we should do it. But those are the ones that are really celebrated, right? And you know, what is it? I think there's a great quote by George Bernard Shaw, and he's got a bunch. I love a lot of his stuff. He's probably one of my favorite, you know, even though he was a playwright and amongst other things, I think he was a philosopher. And it was, I think it's something to the effect of, we all think we count on the reasonable man, but that's the guy that's just going to do everything just like he's supposed to do it. But for us to ever move forward, for us to ever grow, we gotta go with the unreasonable man, the person that's going to do the things differently that no one would expect. So that guy becomes the most important person to our culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I know I'm paraphrasing that and totally destroying it. And hopefully it's even him that said it, but hopefully everybody gets the idea.
Well, I think art's a medium for truth, because you have all those filters and expectations and shoulds inside your head. But when it's art, you can kind of suspend that for a bit. And that's why a lot of times fiction is more real than reality itself, because the characters and the situations imagined, but the principles and the raw truth is more visceral. You know, if I'm in a conversation, you know, I'm going to pursue a confirmation bias, but if it's a story, I can lean back and it can permeate me and it can affect me and it can draw me in effectively. You know, this could wind up being like a 7-hour podcast. Yeah. I could see this. So as we wrap up, two things. One, it's like, you had a question. You said, I have a question for you. Did I just steamroll over the question?
That was the question. Remember, was, or what would be the question is, do you think a business should ram values down somebody's throat or now go spend a weekend seminar and they had five values, but now they're ripping that off the wall and coming up with six new ones. And now everybody's got to abide.
Well, if you're ramming values down people's throats, I question whether or not they're true values. Remember, a value, there's differences between a marketing ploy, socialized weapons, where I try to take moral high ground by claiming to hold a value that's more virtuous than yours. I get power over you, but it's not really a value, because if it's a value, I want it for you, because values blur the lines between me and you. They tend to create us, we, not me. So when you have these values that have been collectively formed by the founders, one of the things that they do for your organization, I mean, recruiting who you have on your team is one of the preeminent critical factors for culture. It attracts people magnetically, the right people, and then it repels other people. It spits them out like a virus. And when you have values that are not truly yours, you try to sell people. You try to threaten them or force those values, impose those values. When those are truly your values, you enroll people. You find people who share those beliefs deeply. Okay. And it helps you define, like you said, I know who Training for Warriors is for, and I know who it's, this was even more powerful for me, who it's not for.
Yeah.
And that's the key there. So as we wrap up, where can we find more Martin Rooney, and how do we pre-purchase? I went on Amazon and pre-purchased your book.
Yeah. Well, hey, the new book is called High 10. And, you know, and I think the subtitle is an inspiring story about how to build a great team culture. And it is saying how Bobby said, it is a story format. So you don't go in there with that bias. You go in there, you enjoy the story, but the story really delivers, again, ultimately a roadmap, a lot about everything that we talked about today, which I'm hoping that people will read and then go back to it again and again, just like they did with the prequel to that, Coach to Coach. So High 10 is actually, it's a continuation of the story 30 years later. It stands on its own, but they both go together, which is pretty neat too. I didn't even say that.
Oh, if it's 30 years later, I have a question about the coach because he was pretty old. Oh, don't tell me.
Yeah, you'll see. Well, yeah, it's going to blow your mind because and there's an ending in this one. This one you're going to love. But here's a special that I want to talk about right now. Bobby, yeah, hopefully we're going to run this relatively soon, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, like 3-4 months. No, this is coming out in 2 weeks. Two weeks, it's coming out.
Yeah, so if you were listening to this right away, or hey, I'll even honor it if you listen to it later. But the book releases on July 7th. And if you purchase, and here's what I'm doing, because I know how good this is and I know how many people need it. If you buy one for yourself and you buy two more to give to two people you really care about, or two people within your business, or two people within your family, I am going to send you not only two bonus PDFs about culture, which you're going to need. I have two chapters that I took out of the book that are two additional chapters you're going to want to have once you've read the book, and an 80-minute presentation that I gave on culture that cost for the event over $500 to attend. So if you buy three and you email me the receipt at martin@coachinggreatness.com, I will send you all of that stuff, and you'll have all that in addition to one great book for yourself and two great gifts for somebody else. But if you want to find out more, hey, go to Amazon or wherever books are sold online. The High 10 book will be there. And maybe to explain, just so you remember, a high five is just you're giving one person one hand, they're giving you one hand. But a high 10, taking a high five to another level, going to the extreme, that's the double high five, if you will. And I'm calling it a high 10. So we're trying to really get that concept out there too, if you understand a powerful culture. And so it's out there everywhere, but you can find me on Instagram at TheMartinRooney, find me on Facebook, or check out coachinggreatness.com, and you'll learn everything about all the books and see a blog, all kinds of stuff. But last thing, because Bobby, I wrote down two words when you were saying what you said about values, and you're going to like it. You ready? Authenticity attracts. So see, you answered it for me. So, hey, the values are okay to have, but you better be authentic in those and live those. And if you do, you're going to attract the people you want. And then those people are going to deliver the culture that you expect. And man, I think that's a great way to bring it all together. And it gave me confidence again, because even I was a little nervous about it, because a lot of words sound great up on the wall, but man, yeah. But if they're not in your heart, man, you're never, then they're not going to beat the hearts of your people.
Thank you, Martin.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Visit the Self-Help Antidote on Instagram. Share your thoughts and let us know what topics you'd like us to explore in the future.